You can go ahead and approach the bench and begin your argument. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Brent Vogel on behalf of Appellants Made LLC, Mr. Hutch and Ms. Tan. As I indicated, if I could get 3 minutes for the rebuttal. I don't see that the clock started, but if I could get that, that would be great. And the issue presented here today is set out in this court's September 21st order, directing further briefing on whether the FAA preempts NRS 597995 under the facts of this case. And the short answer to that question is yes. So by way of, I guess, procedural background in this case, Senior Judge Thompson had granted appellant's motion to compel the arbitration originally. And then the case got reassigned to a different judge, and a motion for rehearing was then filed, which was also granted. And it's important to knowing exactly what the judge ruled and the order at issue. And Judge Escobar overturned Judge Thompson's ruling, finding that his ruling was clearly erroneous because the arbitration agreement lacks NRS 597995-1's specific authorization requirement. Now, this court has addressed this issue before. It was in MMAWC versus Zion Wood Obi-Wan Trust, and this court ruled that that statute is preempted. I apologize, Your Honor. A little heart palpitations here, a little nervous, so I apologize.
Take your time.
The court held that the FAA preempted NRS 597995, and as such, the district court erred by deeming the subject arbitration clause unenforceable under that statute because the clause singled out and disfavored arbitration by requiring a specific authorization for arbitration that did not apply to other contractual provisions. This court noted that the FAA provides that written provisions for arbitration are valid, irrevocable, and enforceable, save it upon such grounds as exist at law or in equity for revocation of any contract. And the court cited to Section 2 of the FAA.
So my question is, moving on to that, since that case was just cited, what in the record in district court can you point us to in the record, which, besides your general statement that food and some services and laundry was supplied to the patient or person who lived there in the nursing home, what can you point to in the record that Interstate Commerce was actually involved in order for the FAA to preempt out the statute?
Yeah. So I think it's
under Ballesteros.
Yeah. So yeah, under the Ballesteros case, which is actually very instructive on these issues, we have the underlying admission agreements. So we have the arbitration agreement, which is in the appendix at page 201. But then we have the actual admission agreement, which is found in the appendix beginning at 190 going through 201. And that admission agreement really sets out the terms of the services that are to be provided. And part of the services that are to be provided include providing food, cleaning services, medical supplies, things along those lines. And if I can find it in my notes here. So in there, and it says the underlying transactions in the admission agreement included the three meals a day and snacks, which is, you know, the food that's referenced by this court in Ballesteros. In the Ballesteros case, this court cited the Katzenberger versus McClung case, the 1964 U.S. Supreme Court case that involved application of the Commerce Clause to a restaurant in Alabama that was purely local. And the court said that the Commerce Clause extends to that business because they serve interstate travelers and food, by its very nature, involves interstate commerce. So in this case, food is one issue, but they also provided bedside care for minor illnesses, cable TV, incontinence and skincare supplies, and first aid supplies. And in this case, the underlying complaint involves the application of a bandage. And that's, you know, that's kind of what that issue is. This bandage was applied, they claimed it was applied too tightly and not removed in a timely manner. And that in and of itself was the underlying complaint. Well, the provision of the bandages also implicates interstate commerce under the FAA. In addition, the payments made under the agreement involve Medicaid, which is...
Were they Medicaid or Medicare?
It's actually Medicaid in this case.
In this case?
In this case.
And where is that in the record that the patient was on Medicaid?
Yes, so in the agreement, it says in the appendix at page 193, one of the funding sources is WERC, and WERC stands for the Waiver for the Elderly in Adult Residential Care, which is a Medicaid program. And in Erickson versus Aetna Health Plan, 84 Cal Reporter, 2nd 76, 1999 case, that court held that the FAA applied to a health insurance contract requiring arbitration because Medicare and Medicaid were involved in the underlying contract. So if we turn back to the Ballesteros case, what we had in the underlying complaint there was it was for construction defect.
And I'm sorry, what was the record on appeal on that? On the
it's in the appendix at page 193.
At
the very bottom, it talks about funding sources, and the boxes are checked private as well as government. And underneath it is written WERC, which is the Medicaid program, and it stands for Waiver for the Elderly in Adult Residential Care. And it's the Erickson case specifically found that, you know, cases involving Medicare or Medicaid involve or implicate the Federal Arbitration Act.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, not at all. So turning back to the Ballesteros case, you know, that case I think is instructional as it compares to this case, because the underlying complaint there was for construction defect and the arbitration agreement at issue was for disputes, quote, involved in the construction of any home. And this court noted that there's multiple out-of-state businesses that provided supplies and services in constructing the homes, thereby implicating the interstate commerce. And in this case, we've got an arbitration agreement that's we've got an underlying complaint that's for negligence related to the provision of services and medical supplies, and in this case, in particular, the bandage. And the arbitration agreement is for any dispute, quote, arising out of or relating to the agreement. And that's in the appendix at page 201, is that language. And in this case, the provision of food services and medical supplies implicates the out-of-state businesses and interstate commerce, similar to this court's reference to the Katzenberger case in Ballesteros. Now, there's a sister court decision that we cited in our briefing from South Carolina that addressed the situation that's quite similar to the one here, and that's the Dean versus Heritage Healthcare case, 408 SC 370, 2014 case. And the South Carolina court in Dean analyzed many of the same U.S. Supreme Court cases this court used in the U.S. home case, as well as the MMWAC case, applied it to the healthcare setting. And in that case, the Supreme Court of South Carolina noted that since the Supreme Court decided the Allied Bruce versus Dobson case, many, if not all, federal and state courts have held that nursing home residency contracts, similar to the one at issue here, implicate interstate commerce and the FAA. Generally, these holdings center on the common theme that nursing home residency contracts usually entail providing residents with meals and medical supplies that are inevitably shipped across state lines from out-of-state vendors. And in that case, you know, they provide a long string cite of those cases. Then the South Carolina Supreme Court then said the terms of the residency agreement implicate interstate commerce and thus the FAA because the appellants were contractually required to provide meals and medical supplies, which are instrumentalities of interstate commerce. They even went on to state that although the meals and medical supplies were irrelevant to that dispute, they must nonetheless be considered because the residency agreement specifically required the appellants to provide those goods and supplies. In this case, the supplies that were provided, the bandage, are actually at issue. So this is an even stronger case than the South Carolina case where they held that the FAA applied to this type of agreement. So the South Carolina court really kind of mirrored a lot of the analysis and language that this court used in the Ballesteros case. And the South Carolina court also was mirrored by a lot of other state courts, and we referenced some of this in our briefing. But the one in particular that I think is kind of illuminating is the Kentucky Supreme Court's case.
I'm sorry, the what Supreme
Kentucky.
Court? Kentucky. Oh, Kentucky.
Well, they held that the FAA applied to an arbitration agreement between a nursing home and a nursing home resident because healthcare in and of itself was an activity involving interstate commerce. And the Kentucky court was actually citing a U.S. Supreme Court case, which has held that healthcare is an activity involving interstate commerce. And the provision of, you know, in this contract and the specific underlying issue of putting on the bandage, that's healthcare. But the case that they cite is Summit Health versus Pinas, 500 U.S. 322, a 1991 case, where the U.S. Supreme Court held that the hospital's purchase of out-of-state medicines and acceptance of out-of-state insurance establish interstate commerce. And as I noted before, in this case, we've got Medicaid as one of the funding sources and the provision of healthcare in this particular case, which would then implicate interstate commerce under the contract at issue here. Now, there was an argument made in the respondent's brief having to do with kind of an ancillary issue, the actual rules set out in the arbitration agreement. I'm not sure if the court's interested in that issue, but I thought I'd address it briefly if it's something the court is interested in. I will take that as I'll speak freely.
I don't know if the others are.
Well, the respondents argued that the arbitration provision at issue in this case was pursuant to the American Health Law Association.
Oh,
they cited some of the
provisions. I know what you're talking about. I'm going to say I don't think that it's proper to get into that because that was not even argued below, and it was not raised until their supplemental.
I appreciate that. I was going to mention that, but in case the court wanted to hear it, I appreciate that as well. I think I've covered most of the points I wanted to make, and it sounds like I focused in on what you wanted to hear with respect to application of Ballesteros as well as the MMWAC. Yeah, and basically to, I guess, conclude at least the first part. I see my time's up, so I will save
okay.
it for rebuttal.
We'll give you rebuttal time. Thank you so much for your argument. Any other questions from the justices? No. Right.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Hunter Davidson, and I represent the plaintiffs in this matter, which are the estate of Thomas DeLeo, Cindy DeLeo, and Thomas DeLeo, Jr. This case is really about state sovereignty and simple evidentiary burdens. One of the cornerstones of preemption jurisprudence is the assumption that a state's historic police powers are not superseded by federal act unless that was the clear and express intent of Congress. And this is known as the presumption against preemption, and it arises out of respect for states as independent sovereigns. United States Supreme Court and the Nevada Supreme Court have routinely and abundantly made clear that the FAA only preempts a state statute when interstate commerce is involved. Now, importantly, interstate commerce cannot be presumed. The party seeking to enforce the arbitration agreement must set forth real and actual evidence that interstate commerce is involved. For those reasons, this court should affirm the district court's order denying the arbitration for the following two reasons. First, the FAA does not preempt NRS 597.995 because the contracted issue does not involve interstate commerce. And second, because NRS 597.995 applies the arbitration provision at issue here, it is void and unenforceable because there's not specific authorization as required under the state statute.
So I have a question as to, I guess, your first point with the interstate commerce. In your brief, in your answering brief, or excuse me, your supplement, you had mentioned that there was no evidence put forth by way of affidavit, like in Ballesteros. And so my question is, what is your response to the appellant's claim that the Medicaid box, for whatever that was checked off in the record in this case?
Yes, sir. That's twofold. First, the point in the record that the defendants have pointed to, it's a handwritten note at the bottom of the page. That's not actual evidence of actual Medicaid payments. We haven't seen anything that Medicaid was actually paid to this facility whatsoever. On top of that, though, Medicaid's a state-run program. And there's
Medicaid is?
Correct. Medicaid is run by the state. It receives some federal funding. But at the end of the day, it is organized and run by the state. In other jurisdictions, they've found that, sure, Medicare might open up to interstate commerce, but Medicaid alone is insufficient. And that arises even out of an Oklahoma Supreme Court case, Bruner versus Timberlane Manor. There we had an Oklahoma resident bringing a case against an Oklahoma nursing home owned by an Oklahoma partnership that was licensed under Oklahoma law. And in that case, the defense or the nursing home made these exact same arguments. Look, we accept Medicaid payments. They found that's not good enough because that's a local state-run program. They also pointed to the use of internet and telephone lines. They said that's a de minimis impact on interstate commerce. If we're going to find that internet and telephone lines open up interstate commerce, then everything is interstate commerce.
So you think that this case, if we agree with you as far as there's some question as to whether or not Medicaid is a state-run program, that this should be remanded back for an evidentiary hearing on whether or not interstate commerce is involved?
No, Your Honor. As the court has indicated in the underlying procedural history before the court here, the defense had every opportunity to bring this issue before the district court, and they failed multiple times. They were given the opportunity here before the Nevada Supreme Court to perhaps correct that.
But so you're saying that the record's complete. It's either, when we look at the appendixes, it's either going to show us one thing or another.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would note that before the order came down order from the district court that's currently up on appeal, the JCCR was submitted 4 months ago. Discovery was actually open, and nothing was submitted to support any of these agreements or any of the assertions by the defense. In addition, the defense has actually submitted an affidavit in this case from Defendant Tun. That is on record page 95, I believe. And in that affidavit she submitted, there's nothing that suggests interstate commerce. In fact, it's just the opposite. She admits that MAID LLC is simply involved in running a nursing home here in Nevada. And I think it's important to distinguish as well the kind of nursing home that we're dealing with in this case. This is not a hospital that's referenced in some of the cases that the defense cites to. This is not a skilled nursing facility that some of the cases that the defense cites to. This is a single family residential home that could be next to, it could be your neighbor in a facility. It's owned by a Nevada LLC. Defendants Tun and Defendants Hutch are both Nevada residents. The defendants admit that in their answer. That's record page 12. The decedent in this case was a Nevada resident, and each of the plaintiffs in this case are a Nevada resident. In the words of that Oklahoma Supreme Court, this is a profoundly local transaction. It's again, Nevada resident getting care from a Nevada single-family home where it's owned by a Nevada LLC, run by Nevada caregivers. It's as simple as that. There's no interstate commerce whatsoever.
So you think that based on this record, we should follow the Oklahoma courts in finding that on this record, this is not interstate commerce, and disregard their points and authorities from South Carolina and Kentucky saying that these types of, it's either one or the other than with the law. It appears that the facts are pretty similar in all of these cases. It's just a matter of what's interstate commerce.
That's correct, Your Honor. But as opposed to those cases cited by the defense, those involve multiple out-of-state parties. A lot of those are large, again, skilled nursing facilities that are subsidiaries of giant national healthcare corporations. That's, again, not what we have here. And in those cases, in the cases that are cited in our supplemental brief as well, there's always one common factor: evidence. There's a declaration. There's an affidavit. There's sometimes receipts or invoices that are submitted. And those aren't just blanket declarations or affidavits that state, yeah, we have interstate commerce. Instead, they pinpoint where it actually stems from. Yes, we receive our food sources from a Florida vendor. Hey, we send our reports to a Florida regional office, which then forwards it to a Maryland corporate office. We receive our prescription medication from a California corporation. We don't have that here. At the end of the day, the defense just has simple legal argument. We don't know where this food has come from. We don't know where those bandages have come from. There's nothing whatsoever that suggests that it's interstate commerce. And at the end of the day, as the party seeking to enforce this agreement, they have the burden, not us, they do. And they fail to satisfy that burden because they cannot set forth any evidence whatsoever that demonstrates that the services under the contract involve interstate commerce or that the supplies came from an out-of-state source as well. And that's the big issue as well, is that that third factor involving supplies, that is just one factor in this case. The larger factors that courts commonly point to, we see it in Ballesteros, we see it in Century Systems versus Guy, we see it in Zion Wood Obi-Wan Trust. In those cases too, you have mixed diversity as far as residency is concerned. In Ballesteros, U.S.
I don't think MAC was a diversity case. I think that had to do with international licensing, period.
Correct. It was a diversity among residents or citizens, not in MAC, though. That case, you are correct, that was a global licensing agreement for the World Series of Fighting. Right. Again, that's foreign commerce, which would fall under the FAA. But if you look at Ballesteros, that's U.S. Home Corp. That's a foreign corporation. There are over, I think, 20 plaintiffs in that case for construction defect. Now you're looking at a mix of different parties from different states, as well as two affidavits that were submitted that said, yes, this construction project would not have been possible absent contractors from out of state, absent subcontractors from out of state, absent supplies that came from out of state. That is far different than what we have here, where, again, we're just looking at simple care at a residential family home located here in Las Vegas, where the defense admits everybody here involved is a Nevada resident, and nothing beyond that comes into interstate commerce. Turning to some of the examples that we have as well, there's an Alabama case that came out of the Alabama Supreme Court, Community Care of America. On the alternative is Bruner, that Oklahoma case. You have an Alabama resident that sued a nursing home that was owned by a Delaware corporation for pressure wounds. In that case, the Alabama Supreme Court rightly found that the FAA did apply. And that's because, again, they found that Alabama resident or nursing home was submitting reports from that home to their regional office in Florida that would then forward that to their corporate office in Maryland. They also came up with specific affidavits that said plaintiff's treatment, not just the general treatment, but plaintiff's treatment required supplies that came from Georgia, Wisconsin, Mississippi, that their medications came from Florida, which was owned from a Florida company that was owned by a California corporation. I would challenge the defense, where do we know where these supplies came from? Where in the record does it say that these supplies, that they came from out of state?
How do you distinguish this from the United States Supreme Court case that was cited to in Ballesteros regarding the Alabama case where they're just giving out food? That's it, food. And they said that the federal government does regulate interstate commerce in that case. I'll let you finish. Because obviously the federal government can uphold discriminatory acts against discrimination, et cetera. And that just dealt with food.
Correct. That was food. But again, that location was located right off a highway. And if I'm not mistaken, it was right at the border of the right at one of the state borders where there was frequent traffic. And again, it's an older case and I'm not entirely familiar, but my recollection is that there was evidence or at least an indication that there was common travel along that highway line, which involves specific interstate commerce. And again, that's much different than what we have here. This home is not involved on a line. There's no evidence of out-of-state residents stopping by. And I understand my time is up.
I interrupted during the question. You've got 4 minutes. Sorry about that. I thought you had rebuttal. Sorry. Keep going.
Thank you, Your Honor. Turning as well to an Arkansas case, Supreme Court case out of Arkansas, Arkansas Diagnostic Center versus Tahiri. That case, too, again, pointed to the importance of these evidentiary burdens. That case, an Arkansas doctor sued an Arkansas medical corporation for breach of his employment agreement. And in that case, the Arkansas medical corporation simply argued, again, no evidence, that it treated out-of-state patients, received payments from out-of-state insurance carriers, and had privileges from out of state as well, where doctors could treat in multiple states. Ultimately, the Arkansas Supreme Court found that no, the FAA doesn't apply there. There's no evidence of any of these out of state connections. There's no evidence of interstate commerce. Even with this large Arkansas Medical Corporation, they demanded that evidence be presented. And based off the record, when they looked at it, the Arkansas Supreme Court said, look, all that we can see here in the record is this is a local clinic with local physicians who have privileges at local hospitals who treat local physicians. And this really pinpoints the importance of you needing evidence in the record to make these demands that the FAA applies. And that's why the Arkansas Supreme Court said that it would not. I think it's also important to take a look at the Nevada Supreme Court of Century Systems versus Guy, because in that case, too, it shows that, one, you need evidence, and then, again, a mix of residency among the parties. In that case, a Nevada franchisee sued a California corporation to cancel the franchise agreement. And there, the Nevada Supreme Court found that the FAA did apply because, one, the parties to the contract were of different states, Nevada and California. And two, when you actually look at the face of the contract, you can see it involves interstate commerce. The California franchisor was providing training and management services to this Nevada franchisee. And in return, the Nevada franchisee was sending payments back over state lines to California to this California corporation. Again, that's not what we have here. We don't have mixed residency among the parties, and certainly don't have any evidence that suggests otherwise. In sum, plaintiffs would maintain, again, the FAA does not apply because all four factors that are cited all favor a finding that there is no interstate commerce. That being said, then, because the FAA does not apply, NRS 597.995 is not preempted. And the statute, NRS 597.995, is very clear. If there's a provision in a contract that says any dispute is subject to arbitration, that provision has to be specifically authorized, whether you sign it, whether you initial it, whether you write your name and address next to it, it doesn't matter. But you have to specifically authorize that provision in addition to generally signing that agreement. The example that we commonly see is Fat Hat, where four out of the six arbitration agreements were voided in that case.
Fat Hat's an unpublished opinion. How do you argue that in light of the Matt case? We specifically said it's preempted by the FAA.
Well, the Matt case, again, you had interstate commerce. In footnote four of the Matt case, the parties, I believe, don't even dispute that there's interstate commerce. The court immediately found that there was, because, again, you have this global licensing agreement that involved the World Series of Fighting. And under just the plain language of the FAA, that applies, because the FAA says it is applicable to contracts evidencing either interstate commerce or foreign commerce. So that's where Matt comes in, is you have the foreign commerce, because it's a global licensing agreement. So the preemption in the Matt case was simply related, or was actually reached properly, because again, the FAA steps in. You have foreign commerce involved, so the FAA applies and preempts NRS 597.995. You don't have that here. There's no interstate or foreign commerce. So therefore, NRS 597.995 still applies. That is not met here. It's not specifically authorized, and therefore, plaintiffs respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's order.
Thank you. We'll hear from appellant and rebuttal.
Thank you. Just briefly, one of the things that I neglected to bring up initially, and which became relevant now, is this court's language in the Ballesteros case, where this court stated, even contracts evidencing intrastate economic activities are governed by the FAA if the activities, when viewed in the aggregate, affect interstate commerce. And this was a citation in Ballesteros citing to U.S. versus Lopez, 514 U.S. 549. And as I think everybody knows, the interpretation of affecting commerce is extremely broad under the FAA and the Commerce Clause. So when you apply it to the record that we have in this case, as well as interpreting case law, the provision of food, medical supplies, services, in the case law indicating that that implicates commerce, and this court's language that even intrastate economic activity can impact the application of the Commerce Clause, I think we have a pretty clear situation where the evidence in this record shows that we've got interstate commerce and the FAA would then apply. One of the things that counsel also mentioned in this case, which I think is inaccurate, is that the burden is on the defense. Under NRS 38, there's a presumption of arbitrability, And I think it's actually under Nevada law, the burden is actually on the plaintiffs to show that the arbitration should not go forward or that the provision is not enforceable. And finally, I didn't hear any comments from counsel indicating that, you know, the provision of, you know, a Medicaid program such as the WERC program, which is noted in the contract, and that's what we have in the record, is the contract saying that that's the funding source, to dispute that that's, you know, it's a federal program and that that would also apply for the court to determine that this is indeed interstate commerce under this case. Therefore, we respectfully request that this court reverse and remand this matter and compel the district court to put this matter into arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you both very much for your arguments. The court really appreciates all your hard work, especially with the supplemental briefing and the arguments here today. I want to thank both counsels, and this will stand submitted. And at this time, the court is going to recess till 11:30.